Today's guest is on a mission to help remove unnecessary eggs from the food chain, something that's as good for the planet as it is for chickens. Ogg's founder Hannah Carter has achieved listings with five of the UK's top six grocers for her egg alternatives and a range of bakery products that use them. That's no mean feat and a massive step towards sustainability without compromise. I can't wait to find out how she's doing it. Welcome, Hannah.
Thank you. Hello.
I guess the first thing is, can you tell us a little bit about Ogg's and why you started the business?
Yeah, so 6.5 years ago, I was still eating steak all day, every day. Not quite, but had a shift and realised that as I'm sort of obsessively tearing the plastic away from the paper on envelopes, if I actually wanted to make a difference and from a sustainability standpoint, I need to change my diet. So I pretty much overnight shifted to vegetarian and then became vegan. And on that journey, I discovered how much hidden animal, as we call it, there was in the supply chain that was there for function and not nutrition. Milk powder in a packet of crisps, egg white and gluten-free bread, because I'm gluten-free, do not want to invite me for dinner. Gluten-free vegan is everyone's worst nightmare. And that was really frustrating because everyone was starting to do meat-free Mondays and trying to make a small contribution. And yet so many of us were eating these hidden animals that were having in the supply chain, but no one's eating a cake for the nutritional content of the egg, you know, or even mayonnaises. And actually, they have a large contribution to the carbon emissions that animal agricultural farming contributes. So I wanted to try and solve that, but at the same time, couldn't be vegan without a blueberry muffin. So I thought this is going to be my Achilles heel. So I started making muffins at home, although I'm a terrible baker. And I started using aquafaba by draining a can of chickpeas. And some days it worked and some days it didn't work. And my background is management consulting in pharmaceuticals for my sins. And I realized that there's a difference in the chemical composition. And if I could understand how to make a consistent and stable aquafaba, we could go upstream. And I don't have to wait for humans to create change. We could literally take the egg out of the supply chain, out of the Tesco value brownies, for example, and nobody would ever know. So I put all the money I had from savings into a food consultancy to get proof of concept to create the first aquafaba.
So you were a management consultant before. Has that been useful? Had you always wanted to start a food business, or were you happy to leave it behind?
Oh, I'd never even, if you told me 6 years ago I'd be running a food business, I'd have thought absolutely not. No, the food has never been on my radar. So I was doing leadership and strategy, and it has been phenomenally helpful. First of all, for fundraising, I'm able to build a deck that is, as an investor would want to see, understand market sizing. In fact, I did a management consulting gig on the business before I started it. What's the size of the market? Who are the customer groups? What are the future trends? How is it going to evolve? What are the routes to market, et cetera? So it actually has allowed me to build a really robust business coming from the management consulting background. And then also from the leadership coaching side, I did so much training and development and working with other people. I'm now doing it live with my own team. And I'm so grateful to have had those two things before I started this business, because A, I don't have the stress levels that I imagine you would have if you don't understand the nature of how we have experience and how we create, where stress comes from, which it isn't the business. It comes from our own ideas about the business, not the business itself. Allows you to, A, make smarter strategic decisions and fundraise in a way where people back and believe what you're saying, because there's credibility behind what you're pitching, but also build a culture, a really open culture of trust, accountability, and fun.
You worked out whether the business would work before you kind of went very far with the actual product and developing the business.
Yes. I actually recently listened to a podcast by the Netflix founder, and he was saying, assume every idea is a terrible idea. And I suppose that's where I started. This will never work. So why could it work? And assessing whether there's actually a market for this or not, because just because I like it, there's been some weird and wonderful hairstyles and outfits that I've bought that I like, but no one else likes, which is why they're in the sale rack, you know. And so the reality is what you like is not necessarily what the market needs. And my background enabled me to start from that perspective, yeah.
How was the search for an alternative to eggs and how much product development have you done to create the two ingredients, aren't they? The two ingredients products.
Well, so the first one came simply from draining cans of chickpea. That is what aquafaba starts as, but it was inconsistent. So really it was a case of, well, what's the optimal chemical composition of an aquafaba? What are the proteins and starches that are required to have as broad a usage as possible with as little flavor profile as possible? So you can't have, although we are in retailers, actually we produce for manufacturers, and manufacturers can't drain cans of chickpeas to make, all the cakes that go on the shelf. So it was about understanding what's the optimal chemical composition. So I worked with, I mean, there was about 6 months where my kitchen just stank of chickpeas the whole time. Worked with two universities across two countries, working with protein teams and a biochemistry team in Portugal to really get to the bottom of what's the optimal chemical composition and what is the method for extracting that, because not all aquafabas are created equal. So that's the work that I did. I remember spending Christmases in the library. For anyone who's interested in getting data, the British Library has pretty much everything ever published. So it's free research, all the Mintel reports, everything. So you can, so I was going in there learning about protein denaturing and trying to understand what's actually happening. So that's how I started. And then the second product, the whole egg, that came from people asking us, well, can you scramble the aquafaba? So it's like, right, okay. And then we started working with another food development consultancy to design it. So I'm not a food developer at all. I find people who are brilliant at all the things that I'm terrible at and bring them together and get them to fill those gaps, basically.
At what point did you sort of quit your management consultancy job to do this full time?
About 18 months from start to full quitting, and I didn't pay myself for the first 18 months, so I needed to cover that. So yeah, it was about 18 months, but I was pretty much part-time within about 4.
What's currently in the range, and in what order did it come? I seem to think the cakes came first as a product with the Ogg's brand on. Is that right?
That's what launched first, yeah. So, but the aquafaba, obviously we needed that to go into the cake. So the cakes were launched in the supermarkets first, but we weren't able to produce the aquafaba at scale to pack it in the levels that it needed to be packed in for us to then be able to sell into manufacturing and food service. So yeah, we launched into the retailers in 2019, into Sainsbury's and Waitrose. And then the year after, we launched some of the retail egg products. But then it was in 2022 when we were able to launch into food service for the first time across the plant egg range.
And where are you currently selling now?
Yeah, so the major malts outside of Morrisons and the discounters, basically, so Waitrose, Tesco, Sainsbury's, Asda, Ocado, for the bakery range, and Sainsbury's, Waitrose, Ocado, Asda for the egg range. But then in food service, you can go to Bill's Cafe and have a scrambled eggs on toast. We're in all the Dishoom cocktails, the Alchemist cocktails, Wagamama's breakfasts, Frankie and Benny's cocktails. So we're sort of spread far and wide, I would say. And we've just taken the egg out of one of the UK's largest pub groups from their mayonnaise-based sauces, so 12 sauces. So I can't say who, but you'll be going to get some mayo with your chips, and it won't have any egg in it, but no one will ever know.
Wow. Approaching sort of food service and restaurants and the cocktail makers, I mean, obviously that's part of the mission to replace egg. Has that helped introduce people to the Ogg's brand from a kind of retail point of view?
Not really, no. They're pretty different consumers and pretty different need states, so the two don't sort of cross over. If you're going to the Alchemist for cocktails, you're not usually thinking about cake. So if you buy cake, you don't make cake, and if you make cake, you don't buy cake. So they sort of sit in quite separate places. But what the Ogg's brand has enabled us to do in retail is to give a really important proof of concept to food service and manufacturing, to be able to show that we're a reputable, stable brand, we're known. So when we go and knock on their door, they sort of, even if they don't know us, they recognize the name, or they go, oh, I think I've seen that logo somewhere. And we've The design, the packaging design was so important for the cakes to give that sort of wallpaper standout, really recognizable brand presence. And so people either say, oh, yeah, I remember the strawberries, or yeah, I remember the logo. And that really helps us to gain traction. And also, every sales meeting, always bring cake. And that goes a long way.
How was the process of getting into supermarkets? Because I think this is the Aquafaba is the first egg alternative in the UK. Was it
Liquid,
right? How easy or difficult was it to convince the multiples that they needed to be stocking that?
pretty tough for the egg side because it's a very niche market. So retail egg has never really been our focus. Really, if you're vegan or you have an allergen, you'll buy the product. Otherwise, even if you're vegan, but for the egg is almost the last thing that people cut out. So people can be vegetarian. That's many people, more people are vegetarian. And then the flexitarians, they'll still eat the eggs because people don't understand that actually egg has a higher carbon contribution per kilo than milk. So it's a very small market. Therefore, you've got small rates of sale, and every centimeter on a shelf in the major retailers is prime space. So it's been challenging, but and the challenge has been finding the right category to go into. So we first launched in the chiller next to two chicks, but you're competing against rates of sale of 100 with butters. So then we moved into the egg category, and they're equally insane rates of sale. And so now we sit in baking, where we've got quite a good rate of sale relative to the baking mixes. So, A, it's a great place to go for where customers are trying to try looking to buy, but also our low rate of sale relative to other categories isn't a low rate of sale to the peers that sit on the shelf. So that's been very important.
We've talked about promoting the brand or being where people eat out. How visible is the Oggs brand in those places, or is it not really about making the Oggs brand visible in those places?
No, it is. It depends on what it is. So the Alchemist, they don't highlight any brands. They're brand neutral, basically. Whereas Bill's, you can see scrambled eggs, and so it just depends on the brand strategy of brands as to whether we're named or we're not named.
And as well as being good news for chickens, how much are Oggs about sustainability more broadly? And obviously, the sustainability of the ingredients and the production. How easy is it to address other areas of sustainability?
So we're a B Corp for a start. So we are as sustainable as we possibly can be. We have it's terrible grammar, but we have a saying which is doing the least wrong. It's not the right thing to do to put cake in a box, but people are always going to buy cake in a box. So the box we put it in has to be as least wrong, as least bad for the planet as we can possibly make it. But our North Star, and this is where I think it becomes really challenging, especially for founders, if you're about sustainability, is you can't solve all the problems. So, for example, our Aquafaba is in a Tetra carton. We can't solve the problem that not all councils recycle Tetra. That isn't something that I, but if we don't put it in a Tetra carton, the food waste would be so high. So you have to say, okay, our North Star is removing as much egg as is possible for carbon reduction and animal welfare. So that's the bit that we always focus on first. And then the next stage is, okay, where can we make a difference? So, for example, in our cakes, our trays, they're the only cake brand on the shelf that has 100% recycled plastic tray that is also recyclable. So that costs us 25% more than a 70% recycled plastic tray. What's so hard is that ethics cost money.
And it's better to make the change. I'm assuming if an alternative to Tetra Pak came along, you'd be straight on it, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. But the reality is, there are very few consumers that, when we're stressed and busy, really spend the time to still choose this is the most sustainable option. And there aren't that many that are really prepared to pay the extra. Everyone on a survey will say that they will. But when it comes down to it and you're buying things and something's 3 or 4 pounds more expensive, we're not obviously, but just as an example, most of us do choose the least expensive one that's maybe halfway there. And I think that's the reality. And most families are worrying about heat or eat. Most people don't have the capacity in the space to worry about these things. And any of us that do, it's a privilege because that means we have more than enough in our lives. Therefore, we have capacity to think about sustainability. But it means that trying to be a sustainable brand and be a price point that is accessible to the majority is a really fine balance.
Yeah, well, especially over the last couple of years, I guess.
Yeah, massively so.
And the B Corp thing's interesting. Is B Corp something you chose and then changed the business to comply with it? Or did it fit pretty well with how you were working as a business anyway?
So my previous company, I was one of the first 10 B Corps in the UK. So I've known about B Corp for a long time. So I set the business up with B Corp values, knowing what I was going to be assessed on, set the articles of association as in B Corp grade. So really the reason why it took us a couple of years to get the B Corp is A, the time, but B, you had to be able to show all the measures and checks you were doing and have you got an employee handbook? And those were things we just didn't have time to develop and do. And then as we got bigger and as the team grew, we had to put them in place, but we were already offering, I don't know, our team get 4 days a year to that paid to go and do charity work. Some of them take a Wednesday afternoon off and go and work with foster children to give them some one-to-one time. Some go and work in the food bank. You know, everyone does something different, but we were doing that before we got our B Corp stamp. You know, so it's inherent within the organization, and we only hire people who's come from is what can I contribute to the world versus what can the world give me?
Yeah.
And so the interview process is very focused around people who want to make a difference, because that is our brand. So what we are on the inside, our consumers feel and customers feel on the outside. So the B Corp is a stamp, but the stamp doesn't make you a B Corp business through and through necessarily.
No, it has to be part of the DNA sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed on the website there's something like 100 recipes.
That's just grown over time. You know, obviously we started, can I make a Victoria sponge? Can I make a muffin? What can we actually make with this? And then obviously as people are searching for vegan recipes, we want them to be using our product, but they need a solution for that. So yes, it's been really valuable for consumers. It's also really valuable for chefs. This is a really new product that most people haven't experienced before. So when we can say to a chef, look, there's a starter for 10 recipe, it's not like, you know, a cake for 60 people, but it's, you know, it's a cake for six. So principally, here's your ratios and percentages of fats and everything else that you would need for this to be effective, for this to work. So again, it's about building credibility and confidence, because you're asking people to change.
Yes.
And we need to give everyone as much reason to believe and confidence to spend their precious time testing something as we can, basically, for it to be effective.
Brilliant. And are you selling outside the UK?
We do. Yeah, we sell in Holland, in the Netherlands, and the Benelux regions. We've got a couple of other countries in Switzerland sell. We're currently in the middle of some international conversations at the moment. But it's really easy, it's really enticing to go international really quickly. But the reality is, you know, we have 0.5% of the cake market and probably not even on the number as a percentage of the egg market. So if we remain really focused, the UK egg market is worth 1.7 billion. When I launched 6 years ago, it was 900 million. It's almost doubled. So if the only thing we do is take 5% of that egg market, focus on that, like that's an enormous business and that's a huge impact.
Yes. And it doesn't dilute your time and focus.
No. And that's the thing, it's dilution. And it's in strategy, I love a 4-box grid. And the one box of what are you not going to do is the most important box, actually. What are you not going to do? Because it's very easy as a small business to try and do everything and have loads of ideas. And interestingly, I was reading this new, it's not new, systemic intuitive thinking or something, I think it's called. Anyway, it's the opposite of thinking outside the box. It's think in as small a box as you possibly can, which then allows you to be creative, but it drives efficiencies. So how can you, within the framework that you've got, how can you be creative? Because it's easy to go, well, we could do anything. And then you become really inefficient. You get loads of different ideas. And actually nothing is, not all ideas are good ideas, actually. Most ideas are terrible ideas and absolutely useless. And it's just a waste of people's time. So if we can actually almost, once you've got the core established, if your innovation is actually about optimizing what you already have and driving efficiencies within what you've already got, that's where you'll start to get a really sustainable business.
I think it's really interesting for founders where there's so many things to do. You've got so many hats to wear, and there are so many opportunities. And I guess there's often a feeling of, should I be
Yeah.
doing this? Should I be doing that? And I think that's really good advice, trying to block out things that are going to take you away from maximizing what you need to do, I guess.
Totally. We spent our first 2 years chasing down every opportunity. 90% of them never went anywhere. And actually, if we'd have been smarter and sharper in the beginning on what are we not going to go for, what is an out of scope, that would have been hugely helpful. I mean, of course, in much of that, there's so much learning that comes as well. So with the growth and development Polly and I have been through together, my co-founder, in understanding this market, and the falling over is where we've done the most learning. You know, when we've had this massive opportunity with a huge manufacturer, we've just completely mucked it up because we didn't understand to ask about the type of egg they use and, you know, and a few other questions, and it's gone completely wrong. And we spent weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks on it. Now we know for next time, but just not chasing everything is really difficult. And you can end up being scatty and going here, there, and everywhere. But getting really clear is so important to be to not burn through cash, and to have a sustainable, financially sustainable growing business.
Talking of things that you can waste a lot of time on, what marketing channels have you tried, and which ones tend to work best for you?
Well, there's an interesting one because I think it completely depends on your product. So just in context for us, you can't post any of our products. You can, but the weight of the aquafaba versus the price means it's totally inefficient on something like Amazon, really. And cakes don't post. So we have, certainly from a consumer perspective, our marketing is all in store. All we do, and my marketing team get very annoyed that I'm not being more creative than this, but it doesn't work. Cake, 60% of cake is an purchases is impulse purchase. So actually, us standing out on the shelf with a really razor sharp, clear message and ensuring the quality is so good people want to buy it again, that's all we need to do. The only other thing we do is geo-targeting around stores. So we'll geo-target anyone within who comes within a mile of a Tesco store that we happen to be in, they get hit, and we do see a rate of sale increase there. But because we're not a subscription business or an online business, that paid social plays a role, but it's not everything for us. But like billboard advertising, things like that, absolutely would not be touching right now, because unless you can be on the bus, on the tube, outside Tesco's, on the Finn, for a year to really get that brand rate. I mean, even if that was only 6 weeks, the brand recognition, we don't have the money. You know, pharmaceuticals, you'd say you'd have to go and have a face-to-face meeting with a doctor 15 times for them to remember two messages. And that's face-to-face, you know, versus the subliminal messaging that everybody has. So we're really prudent about where we spend that money, because for us, even Barkers and Finns, for example, we don't see an uplift. So for us, it's all about the quality of that packaging and what we're telling people on that box. That is our number one marketing tool for us. So which is not usually, it's not the sexy, you know, above the line marketing that most people like to do at all. But we're not big enough yet to sustain that and for it to have the impact that we need it to have.
How big's the team, and how has it evolved, and are there particular things that you're keen to bring in-house and as you grow?
We're about 17 now. And I think that there are core roles that every business needs, and the key account management team, things like accounting you could outsource, but we have it in house. R&D is easy to outsource depending on your pace of research and development. We have an R&D lead, but then we use third parties. But mostly the team is in-house at the moment because they're full-time roles. We run a very lean organization, but it being in-house does allow us to have synergies and pace and efficiencies that we might not have if we were outsourcing too much.
And can I ask about how you funded the business?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I invested the first amount myself, and then we have angel investors, and we have one large corporate investor.
Have you thought about crowd funding and things like that?
Yeah, we've done seeders. It's a lot of time for not a lot of return. And it's more shiny than it seems, I would say. We wouldn't do it again.
What are the most important things you've learned? And is there anything you wish you could go back in time and tell yourself that would have saved pain, cost, heartache?
I think the biggest thing is we hired too fast. I think it's a very common problem. We hired for what was going to come, not for what was here. And that we burnt through some cash doing that. And we didn't change that soon enough. So I could see it, but took too long to change it. So I would hire slowly because you'll be surprised how far you get, even though there feels like there's a lot on. And when you need to make change and you know it, just make the change.
That's very good advice. What are the big scary goals for Oggs over the next couple of years?
I've never called them that before.
Maybe they're not scary. Maybe they're just important.
Yeah, I mean, it's very boring, but we've got our strategy really clear now on who we're targeting and how we need to target. Across food service and manufacturing. And it's a question of literally just executing on it now. We've spent a year learning a lot and getting clear. So now it's actually the boring part, which is again, 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 and that relentless consistency of keeping on track, not getting distracted and pushing that through. So I think that the hardest thing will be is not getting the distraction, but it's about really unlocking some of those major manufacturers to remove serious amounts of egg from that supply chain.
Brilliant. We have a question. Krish asks, did you use freelancers for packaging, branding, or an agency? And what is a decent budget for this?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, so Pete is still with us. He's technically a freelancer, but he's Oggs through and through, really. And it was me and him in the beginning. And I spent £2,000 on the whole brand. You could easily spend 40 with an agency. My background is marketing, and I had Pete, who I'd worked with before, who is a really experienced and talented creative. So I think it's how long was a piece of string on how much do you spend? But certainly in the beginning, I mean, the logo I designed, we were supposed to be called Alternative Foods, and we sat in front of an investor. The cakes were Alternative Foods, the eggs were Oggs. And he went, "Why have you not called the whole brand Oggs?" I was like, "Oh, I don't know. That's a great question."
I'll take that away.
And so we were about to launch into Waitrose, and we had 9 weeks, and we were about to press go on the packaging. So on a PowerPoint deck, I designed the logo, I sent it to Pete, because he was working with another client, and went, "Are you happy with this?" He went, "Oh yeah, that looks great." That was it. That was where the logo came. And I think definitely with creative, you can overthink it, but if you get a really tight brief and start with the end in mind of who it's going to go to, that really helps. And ours was all about an everyday cup of tea, accessible brand that's playful and light-hearted, but gets an important message across.
That is brilliant. That's fantastic advice. Thanks so much to Hannah for joining us. You can find out more, find stockists at www.loveogs.com. And you can, of course, listen to previous Food Founders interviews at www.froghop.co.uk/podcast. or search for Food Founders Interviews wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again, Hannah. That was a brilliant session full of really great advice, I think, for people to learn from. And I look forward to seeing Ogs growing and growing over the next few years.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for having me. Bye.